from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, Berkeley sociologist Arlie Hochschild spent 5 years in the Louisiana Bayou talking with Tea Party activists and other white working class conservatives. What she found might surprise you: common ground, lasting friendship, and more to the story of their political views than just that they've been duped to vote against themselves. Hochschild chronicles her journey to the heart of our political divide in her new book, Strangers in Their Own Land. Join our conversation with Arlie Hochschild right after these headlines. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Over the course of 5 years, Arlie Hochschild has been to Trump rallies, fish fries, Pentecostal church services, and Tea Party gatherings in Louisiana Bayou country, a stronghold of the conservative right, on a mission to answer the questions that confound her about, quote, red America, including why so many on the political right seem to vote against their economic and environmental self-interest. Hochschild found answers much deeper and more personal than she'd expected. As we prepare to elect a president during what feels like one of the most politically divisive periods in modern history, Hochschild has also discovered ways to bridge the divide, and she shares all of this in her new book, Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right. Good morning, Arlie Hochschild.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for being here. You know, as I was reading your book, we are all very troubled, I think, by the depth of our political divide. But I was wondering what made you want to take that extra step of essentially embedding in what you describe red America and sitting and listening for a long time to people in Louisiana.
Yeah. Well, you know, 5 years ago when I began this journey, I actually didn't know anybody that was a member of the Tea Party. I barely knew any Republicans. and I thought, since half the nation is Republican and some 20% agree with the ideas of the Tea Party, I was really ignorant. And so I thought I better do something about this. And because we're all in enclaves, and when people move, they move not for better weather and cheaper houses and more high-paying jobs. They move for neighborhoods of political compatibility, increasingly. And so we're in these enclaves, and I thought, you know what? I'm in Berkeley, California. I love Berkeley. These are my people. But I'm isolated from the rest of the country. So I better go to an equal and opposite place. Where would that be? And I knew the biggest moves right were among whites and in the South. I thought, okay, white South. And where would that be? Where in the white South? Well, I looked at the 2012 data on the proportion of whites voting for Obama, and it was 46% in California. It was 29% of whites in the whole South and 14% of whites voting for Obama 2012 in Louisiana. So Louisiana was like the super South. Even souther than the South. Okay, let's go there.
Yeah. And the other thing that made Louisiana so interesting, too, is that it is a place that, is suffering from high levels of poverty, teenage unintended pregnancy, but also from environmental pollution. And I thought that was so interesting, because what became such a focal point in your book was you would meet victims of intense environmental pollution who were completely against environmental regulation.
Yeah. But, you know, these friends that I came to know and respect were extremely aware of this. They're highly...
You mean of the pollution?
Of the pollution and of the paradox that they're living with. So this isn't a question of ignorance or... And they were very, I should back up to say, friendly and outgoing and wanted to talk with me. And I was very touched by that. And it occurred to me that what I had to do was turn my own alarm system off and really listen. You know, maybe liberals have something to learn here. Maybe we're missing the boat. Maybe there's stuff we don't see or hear. So the project for me and the journey was to kind of try and feel the way they do about, in this case, you know, the polluted environment.
You had made the point that we wrongly, quote, wrongly imagine that empathy with the other side brings an end to clear-headed analysis.
Yes.
So is that a common feeling, that empathy makes our judgment cloudy?
I think that's right, and it's a huge mistake. I think people, and today the more anxious we are about our political moment, the more we take facts together and like forge them into darts and swords and paragraph by paragraph kind of hurl them as if we don't in fact expect to do more than affirm the way we see the world. And I think we have to back up and meet our opposite numbers because they're there to do it too. They're disturbed by this division too. And we can say, oh, look, half the American population may vote for Donald Trump. And all you see are the ultra-right kind of very angry and openly racist. But there are a lot of people, and they're the ones I met in Lake Charles, Louisiana, and Bayou Corn and places around the state, who felt Trump came to them and seemed an answer to something that they didn't have or see other answers to. So
To almost a loss of honor.
Yes, yes. I think if I were to kind of put it in a nutshell, the story I would hear time and time again was, oh, you liberals, you're insulting us. You know, you think we're backward and you think we're in a region that's undeveloped. And if our region is poor, then we must be kind of down and out. So they felt denigrated for their region. As religious people, they felt, whoa, it's an increasing secular culture out there. And so you can't say Merry Christmas at Christmas time. You have to say Happy Holidays or even just Happy. And so they felt, you know, marginalized in that way. And then they felt that all of their views, their pro-life, pro-family views were denigrated and, oh, well, you're homophobic and you're racist and you're sexist.
Meaning that that's what they felt like people were accusing them of in terms of
labels. Exactly. And that and calling them rednecks. And these are college educated people who came from, you know, they were the children of plumbers and pipe fitters who worked very hard to make the world go round. And they felt both hurt and mournful for losses, a variety of kinds of loss. There was a mourning, I feel, mm-hmm. and upset, angry.
We're talking with sociologist and Berkeley resident Arlie Hochschild about her new book about the American right, Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right. Hochschild spent 5 years with Tea Party conservatives in Louisiana Bayou Country, listening, documenting, and wrestling with political views very different from her own. Arlie Hochschild, could you tell us the story of Lee Sherman? Just, I found his story fascinating because he really reflected the paradox that you're talking about, but also how deep it really goes, that it's not ignorance.
Yes. Here was a man, he's now in his early 80s, but looking back at his career as a pipe fitter and pipe inspector, he had a job at Pacific Plate and Glass, PPG.
Was it Pittsburgh Plate?
Pittsburgh, mm-hmm. Yes, thank you. In in around Lake Charles, Louisiana, of fixing, seeing if there were leaks of very dangerous chemicals, ethylene dichloride, vinyl chloride, and so on. And he was difficult work. And one time he was fixing a pipe, and elsewhere in the plant, someone didn't know he was doing it, and some EDC came, and he had a shower of this thing. It burned all his clothes off. The only thing was the rubber on his underpants that was left. And yet, this tells you a little about the culture of the company. This would be in the 1970s, he's describing. The guy said, well, we'll reimburse you for your clothes. Just go out and get some new ones and give us the bill. And so he did. He himself was in shock from this and came back with the bill. And the guy said, well, but your pants had already had some use to them and the shoes. So we're going to deduct some of the value of your new clothes, and gave him a check for $14 or something. And he said, I never cashed. I just kept it. Just what a thing. He became ill at this, and his so tough job. And he was then given the job of taking the industrial toxic waste from this plant, and in the evening looking left and right to make sure he wasn't seen, hauling something called a tar buggy and to the edge of a bayou and turning a valve so that this toxic waste spewed out into the bayou. And he was given this job. He did it twice a day. He said no one ever saw me. He tells of having rescued a bird that plummeted as if shot when it inhaled the fumes. Yeah. He himself, had an inhaler on. So he does this. Then he gets sick from the fumes himself. He goes on medical disability and then is later fired by the company for absenteeism.
Yeah, it was unbelievable. And then,
he's a Tea Party guy today.
Yeah, he's a Tea Party guy today. And, even so, after all of this, as you can imagine, then, the water becomes totally polluted and you can no longer fish in the contaminated waters. And, the company is trying to say that they have little to nothing to do with it. And in walks Lee Sherman to a meeting of this company with, fishermen saying, this company is responsible for contaminating the water because I dumped that toxic waste.
I'm the guy that dumped it. And right. 1,000 fishermen were astonished. They were all set to blame the government for putting out a fish advisory, which would cut into their business, because how could you sell a lot of fish if people thought the fish had mercury in them? And so they were all set to blame the quote big regulators when Lee got up and said, actually, it's the company that did this, and I was the point guy.
And
got fired.
And even though, as you write, that the central betrayal in his life was at the hands of a corporation, an industry, that he still feels most betrayed in life by the federal government.
Yes, yes. That's right. Why? This is the thing. And he's putting lawn signs out for the local Tea Party candidate for Congress. He feels very strongly, goes to the Tea Party meetings. I think we have to back up and look that for him and others I talk to, they feel like they're between a rock and a hard place. On the one hand, they see the face of new global capitalism is that jobs are being offshored to cheaper labor pools. Cheap labor is being imported. Filipina pipe fitters are being imported, plans to, in Lake Charles. And it's highly automated, so the good jobs are going. And yet it's hard to blame the private sector, because that's where you get your jobs. So that's the rock It's there. You can't see it. And it's hard. It's implacable. And on the other side, they see the federal government as a giant marginalization machine. They see all that the government is doing for affirmative action women, for blacks, for immigrants, for refugees, good wages for public sector workers. All of these groups they see as pushing them back in line for the American dream. And so if that's what the federal government is doing, if it's so misusing their precious tax money, they kind of despair of that. So that's the rock and that's the hard place. And Lee was right in the middle of it, even though he had been so punished.
Talking with Arlie Hochschild, her new book is Strangers in Their Own Land, about her experience spending 5 years in Louisiana's Bayou Country with Tea Party conservatives. And she is a professor emerita of sociology at UC Berkeley. And she'll be at Books, Inc. in Berkeley on Tuesday, September 6th at 7 p.m. next Saturday in Oakland at 6:30 p.m. On September 14th. She'll be in Mill Valley at the Commonwealth Club of California. California's Outdoor Art Club at 8 p.m. And she'll also be at UC Berkeley at 6:30 on October 13th. So a lot of appearances where you can talk with Arlie Hochschild about her experiences. What role does media play? One of the things that I think has been, pointed to as a way to foment more hatred, I guess, of the federal government has been like Fox News or
yes.
or Rush Limbaugh. What role do those sources play in Louisiana?
Huge, huge. Studies have shown that half of Tea Party people rely exclusively on Fox and the other half mainly on Fox. And people talked about Fox News, as some of them did, as if it were family. Bill O'Reilly is daddy, and then Hannity is the difficult uncle. Each one had the smartass daughter. Each had their role. And one woman I interviewed met me. I got into her SUV, and automatically Fox Radio came on in the car. I stayed with her in her home, and there was by her computer a small TV, and there was Fox. And then at 5:30 in the evening, she and her husband would watch a large TV, and that was Fox. And the rhetoric of Fox was much stronger and harsher than the rhetoric I heard among the people that I talked to that were teachers and accountants and some pipe fitters and high school custodians who spoke quite gently. So it was as if the harshness wasn't mirrored by the listener, but it was surrounding them and but expressing a kind of malaise that rang a bell for them.
Yeah. And, was there an awareness, though, that Fox is politically right? That it is an advocacy journalism organization, I guess, because it advocates a position.
No. Fox felt like the truth to them. And only a few said, I channel surf and I do a tasting of MSNBC, for example. But there I feel like I'm called redneck. And they felt in a way excluded by the other channels, and the polarization had kind of pushed them away and back into Fox.
Yeah. And so what really became clear, the other example that you gave that has been used as an explanation for, why we've become so polarized and why it feels like certain perspectives have become more extreme on the political right as opposed to the left. You say the right has moved right. The left has remained relatively the same in terms of its political leanings. But the right has moved right, is this notion, too, that there are, powerful billionaire Republicans who are controlling the message, right? The Koch brothers, for example.
Although the Koch brothers don't like Donald Trump. So for all the money they've put into it, they've lost lost a little control, actually. I think they don't know what to do.
But you felt like that explanation was inadequate in terms of, you know, billionaires kind of pulling the strings.
Yeah, no. And in fact, I talked to one Tea Party guy who said, you know, let's get money out of this story. I think it's part of what's escalating the rhetoric, creating machines on one side and the other. Let's just talk to each other. And I thought, wow, that's a crossover issue if I ever heard one.
Campaign finance reform?
Yeah.
So what really was driving all of this, what really powerfully emerged to you was emotion, like a sense, like you say, the sense of marginalization, the sense of being disrespected.
That's right. And loss. That there just was a great sense that they have lost, first, a kind of a cultural sense of identity and centrality, and demographically, they felt on the wane, increasingly marginal group of white Christians, and economically, the trap door at the bottom of the working class that has already injured blacks in our culture. Now that's now whites are vulnerable to that. They thought, oh. Wow, we're surrounded on all sides, and they felt a hurt pride, and they didn't feel environmentally like this was their land anymore either.
And so those emotions are a very powerful driver, right, of action. And you found that it was really, you know, an undercurrent of explanation behind rationalizing some of their political views, even in the face of facts that might go against or contradict what they believe.
Well, there's a moral self-interest. I mean, I don't think progressives or liberals are, in fact, following their own economic self-interest either. I mean, a lot of progressives and liberals believe in taxes, that this is good. It beefs up a public sector, gets better schools, gets better museums and unmarked sidewalks and theater, that there's a public, vibrant public life that they believe in and so happily pay taxes for it. They want public institutions to do for all its cultural beliefs. So they pay their taxes. That, you could say, is against their economic self-interest. But I think we all, in a way, come down to moral and emotionally infused values that represent who we feel we are and what we take pride in, and that those are based on what I call deep stories. And in a way, we're talking across our deep stories, and we need to understand our own and those of the opposition.
Well, we'll talk more about the deep story you pieced together from your time in Louisiana after the break. We're talking with Arlie Hochschild, sociologist and Berkeley professor, who's written a new book called Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right. Join the conversation. What strikes you so far about what you've heard from Arlie Hochschild? Do you have similar experiences of meeting and listening to people that you disagree deeply with politically and found that listening openly without judgment, something happened? Let us know. Give us a call at 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786. I'm Mina Kim. You're listening to Forum. Stay with us. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking with Berkeley sociologist Arlie Hochschild. She's a professor emerita of sociology at UC Berkeley, and she's written 9 books, including The Second Shift, Working Parents and the Revolution at Home. Her latest book is Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right. And it's about her exploration of the lives, political views, and emotions of the far-right white working class residents of the Louisiana Bayou. And I'd like to invite you to join the conversation if you have any thoughts at 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org. You can post them on Facebook, on our website, kqed.org/forum, or you can tweet us at @KQEDForum. Sean comments, I'm a lefty, far left enough to be a socialist, but I'm exceedingly uncomfortable with the way today's Hillary-biased media treats conservatives and or Trump supporters like they're some alien species that humans need to understand. They're people like the rest of us, and they have political opinions. Did your views...
Amen.
There was this very interesting part of your book where you go to a meeting of the Republican Women of Southwest Louisiana. And what I found so fascinating about that meeting was, rather than focusing on sort of big issues that Louisiana faces in terms of poverty and environmental pollution, they were really upset about little things that they felt like the government was really intruding on their lives, like, you know, encouraging them to use LED light bulbs or making them, you know, put helmets on their kids to ride bikes or putting salads on fast food menus. It was like this real sense of intrusion, over-intrusion.
Right. But they were catching one part of something that I felt was true, and that is that the large companies that were polluting their area, making it the sky hard to see and make you have to drink bottled water, that pollution was not being regulated. Like, there was no regulation at the big guy part of the story. In other words, but then micro regulation at the level of the individual. So it was a kind of a displacement of regulation. And in a way, they felt like they couldn't take on these big companies, even though they were suffering at the hands of them. But they had a dissatisfaction to express.
And again, that is a dissatisfaction that you would also hear on the left, of course, that, sure, you know, we're just not focused in the right areas in terms of where regulation needs to happen, or we're too cozy with industry, you know, our government regulators.
Exactly. It's a crossover issue, I think. And but at these Republican Women of Southwest Louisiana meetings, so interesting. They were very large, very well organized. There was a Bellini Super Black Eagle II shotgun being raffled off, and everybody, you know, pleased at that. And the meeting began with prayer, and a salute to the flag with "Under God" in it. And then very friendly people, very delicious food, very, you know, I'd ask, could I talk to you later and have lunch? And then people would say goodbye and retreat to their enormous, large SUVs in the parking lot. I just felt in a different world. It wasn't just one or another person, but the whole world, the press there, the political speeches there, the churches there, the industry there. It was a Tea Party world. It was an enclave, just as we're in an enclave.
Yeah. The Tea Party is as much a culture.
Exactly.
As a political position or a political group. Courtney in Massachusetts. Hi, Courtney. Join the conversation.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I feel like I've tried to have similar conversations with folks in my own family, and things don't always go very well. And so I'm just so curious to know, I mean, really, how did your guest approach people, get them to talk to her, and then how did you speak with them? How did you get people to open up? And I mean, I don't know if you were changing anyone's mind or anything like that, which is, I guess, probably one of the things I'm actually trying to do, and maybe that's part of the problem. But I'm just so curious how she spoke with people and got folks to open up. Thank you, Courtney.
Yes, that's a great question. It actually wasn't hard. I just took my alarm system off for a period of time. And I'll give you an example of how one conversation went. I met a wonderful gospel singer, the wife of a Pentecostal minister in a megachurch in that town. And she was, it was at this Republican Women of Southwest Louisiana meeting and around the table. And she said, "Oh, I love Rush Limbaugh." And I thought to myself, wow, he's angry, opinionated. It's hard for me to hear him. I thought, that little thought streaked through my mind. And then I thought, that's not why I'm here. And I said to her, you know, I'd love to have tea with you. Could I and learn about that? And she said, sure. So we sat down, you know, a few days later over tea. And she said, "Oh, Rush Limbaugh's my brave heart, she called him, and I followed the Rush doctrine. And then she explained that what she really loved about him was that he hated feminazis. Well, I've often written about, been concerned about issues of working moms and getting flexible work hours and, you know, men to help at home and so on. And she, to her, that was that set of issues, parental leave, didn't ring a bell. And so she looked at my face. I was silently absorbing it. And she said, was that hard to hear? And I said, actually, no, it's not what I believe, but it wasn't hard. I just turned it off. And she said, oh, I do that too. I can do that, you know, and I know what you're doing. And then she said, you know, to tell you the truth, the feminists, why I believe this is they make me feel like I'm old-fashioned. You know, I fix my husband's plate, she said, every dinner. He never fixes his own plate, she said with pride. And I feel like that's being put down and that, you know, feminism just represents greedy women, you know, each trying to get theirs. I said, well, no, that's not the feminism I embrace at all. And so we kind of came to a strange agreement. And that's kind of how it went. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Rosa in San Francisco, you have a question about this as well. Yeah.
And this is a great segue, actually, because I was going to ask your guest how her, who she is, her age, her the fact that she's a extremely liberal person from Berkeley affected how people disclose information to her. I certainly don't disclose my most extreme liberal views to even my friends, let alone strangers. And the fact that they're plugged into Fox News and they're screaming and yelling at Trump rallies, that is meaningful. And I appreciate her, Ms. Hochschild's attempt to create a bridge, but there is extreme non-compatibility here between liberal views and the extreme right. And it's pervasive, and I think it's entrenched, and I recalcitrant, and it's getting more extreme, not less. Mm-hmm. And I don't understand how she, you know, I mean, it's all nice and cozy to have this nice little chat with these people, but at the same time, when she's not there, and they're with people of like mind, I'm sure their views are expressed in a very different way.
Rosa, thanks.
That's a great comment. Was there a difference between how they talked to me and how they talked when I wasn't there? Surely. But I tell you, something extra and I think very precious was created by these encounters. And I don't say just by me, but by them. I introduced myself as Arlie Hochschild. I'm a retired sociology professor, and I live in Berkeley, California, which is a Democratic state, and that's who I am. And I feel I live in something of an enclave, and that you do too, and that there's a division, increasing split between these enclaves. And I've come to try and find out about yours, and they were very open about that, you know, and good, you know, come with me to the Republican women, come to me with the rally, come home, I'll show you my kids' school. They were surprisingly open about that. And they told me how they felt. And they too are looking for crossover issues. At the rallies that you see on television, probably that 5% of Americans on the right aren't looking for crossover issues there. But there are a lot of people that are going to be voting for Trump that are.
How many people did you talk to?
Altogether 60 over the 5 years of research, and 40 of those were Tea Party supporters. So 20 were interviews around them to try and get a feel of the whole situation. Yeah, 4,600 pages of transcript. A lot of talking, a lot of listening.
Well, Rick writes, I'm a conservative voter that worries not about gay marriage and other social issues, but about the betrayal of our Constitution. The idea that the federal government increases in power each day while spiraling into debt with no concern for our kids should worry us all. What happens when the money runs out and the music comes to a stop? The writer giggles about the right and their ignorance, but think about it. Who could possibly claim that the left is not packed full of the same ignorance? Please, from an ignored conservative in a deep blue state, we all need to be more centrist to solve our mutual problems.
Mm-hmm. Well, the commentator has it wrong that I'm giggling about ignorance. I mean, that's kind of the point of the book, is actually to move away from that perspective and actually listen. So, clarification on that. And
In terms of the crossover issues, right, when you said that one of the things that you talked about was that environmental protection could be a crossover issue, that addressing global capitalism could be a crossover issue, which is something that we also – there were echoes in, in our different presidential candidates' speeches on both sides about their concerns over global capitalism and the effect it's having on the American worker.
That's right. Exactly. And how can we get people trained for the jobs that are there? How can we get American industry stay in America? Those issues, I think, are crossover issues.
So how do we get there?
Well, I think, first of all, by building an empathy bridge so that we talk respectfully to one another and don't polarize each other. That's, I know, hard to do in this anxious political moment lead up to this election, but I think we need to build a bridge, and there are people on the other side eager to do it.
Well, Ben writes, there's a phenomenon I would describe as reverse provincialism, where coastal and urban liberals have an incredibly distorted sense of human geography, history, and culture. I've met too many Californians who couldn't tell me where Minnesota was, or even that it's a state, and yet thought that everyone between the coasts was uneducated.
Right, right. That's something I often heard at the beginning. Oh, we're the crossover state. Yeah, thanks for listening to us.
Well, Alva writes, I read your article in Mother Jones. Do these people truly understand that what they have to lose in the social programs they depend on? And you do talk about this, that, this region receives, I don't know, of their budget.
44% of Louisiana's state budget comes from the federal government. And that's both Medicaid and it's a flood control.
And what was the rationale? How did people reconcile accepting federal government aid?
They didn't like it. They don't like aid at all. They feel it's shameful. And they shame those who receive forms of aid. And so it's something they avoid. And many of them supported Bobby Jindal, the former Louisiana governor, when he refused federal expansion of Medicaid to Louisiana, although it is now the poorest state.
Yeah. And there was also, I think, a real championing of endurance, right? The value of being to be able to endure and sacrifice.
That's right. I call it the deep story self. But there is a great stoicism and capacity to carry on, to deal with bad news. And I think they feel that that's not valued either, that we don't even know how brave they've had to be to live lives as unprotected, in fact, as they are.
And we go to Joe in Oakland. Hi, Joe.
Hi there. How are you?
Great.
I would like to know about is if the author there has experienced something that I've noticed, and that is to say, where the Republicans are willing to indulge in, well, where the conservative elements, let's say, are really willing to indulge in a lot of scapegoating, like blaming Mexicans and Muslims for various things, it's at least specific. It's incorrect, it's hateful, it's scapegoating, but it's specific. Whereas I look at a lot of the way that the discussion comes out of the the left camps, it's like the things we're saying, except for Bernie Sanders, they were really nebulous things that were being said. I mean, Hillary Clinton doesn't ever seem to say anything of substance. She never seems to speak to the actual issue about the cause and effect between a problem and a solution. And it's really disappointing to me as a liberal because I want the liberal agenda to move forward, but the conservatives and the Republicans have a clear advantage in their in getting their message out because it's at least specific. Why can't the left say specific things about people, about the problems that the broad majority of people in America, in the United States of America, have?
Well, if you look, I don't know about Hillary, but if you look at specific states, I think there are, I'll give you one example. There is someone running for senator in Vermont, and following the Bernie plan to fund community college education and technical college, because in Vermont, for example, they have the highest proportion of graduates from high school, but the lowest proportion of people going on from high school, which you need to do to get a good job. So that's a specific thing to do. Hey, help those 18-year-olds, you know, take it 2 years further and get a good job. And I think that a lot of the, quote, specific policies being offered on the other side by Donald Trump have a very promissory quality. I mean, build a wall and, you know, how big a system would you need to vet absolutely every illegal immigrant? I mean, wouldn't that cause enormous rise in taxes and further debt? The kinds of machine you would need to carry out these, quote, specific promises, it's promissory. And it has that, I think, ephemeral quality. So it's not that the right is being specific and clear and the left is being fuzzy. I think there's a lot of fuzz on the right side.
Well, Joe, thanks for the call. You know, the other thing Joe raises is just about, you know, how they – he was talking about Republican media or Republican candidates will specifically target groups like Mexicans or Muslims. And one of the things I found interesting in your book when you were interviewing, you know, white working class Tea Party conservatives is that you also felt that there was much more of a willingness to maybe specifically denigrate Muslims or Mexicans as opposed to African Americans.
Yes. There was a great silence around American blacks. And I think it's because they didn't want to they were afraid I would think they were racist. And I think there was an avoidance of it. I don't think they were silent at home about it, but I think they were silent to me with it. But they were very open about their fear of Muslims, although there's less than 1% of people from Muslim countries in Louisiana. But there was, you could feel a palpable fear. Oh, well, they are running the gas stations. And what if they refused us gas? I mean, we couldn't get to work. And this is, you know, and they just help each other. So you could see what a, you know, and now Sharia law may be coming to Louisiana. And you could see how a panic sort of could develop that didn't have a demographic base.
So talk a little bit about what you call the deep story, which so as you were trying to explore and try out these different, you know, reasons for why people may have fostered particular political views, what seemed to resonate with most of the folks and was this narrative that you constructed called the deep story that you even presented to them to say, does this reflect your experience? Could you just share a little bit about what that deep story is?
Exactly. I was interested in feeling and felt that feelings takes a narrative form, and the narrative that fit was of people waiting in line. It's like a pilgrimage up a hill, and at the top of the hill is the American dream. And as you're waiting in line, you recall how you have worked extremely hard. You've really earned every penny that you've earned with your sweat and toil and a stoical self. And then as you're waiting, you're noticing that the line is not moving. And as you're waiting, you're noticing that various people are butting ahead in line, you feel. Who are they? Well, they would be affirmative action blacks, affirmative action women. They would be immigrants. They would be refugees. And even public sector workers that seem to be earning more for their hour than you are as a private sector worker. And then you notice that a man in charge of overseeing the line in a fair, dispassionate way seems to be beckoning to the people cutting in line. In fact, he seems to be their ally. That would be Barack Hussein Obama as the ally of the people that are pushing you back in line. And that's an alliance that puts the government really on the side of your marginalization. And then you begin to think of, hey, I guess that's what the federal government does. Everything it does isn't good and has the function of pushing me back and not helping me. And so I am a stranger in my own land. This isn't my own government even. That's the feeling, I think, that has been expressed. And then you see someone ahead of the line turning around and saying, oh, you redneck, you know, and you feel insulted, on insult to injury, and you are alienated. You are a stranger in your own land.
And hence the title of your book, Stranger in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right. We're talking with Berkeley sociologist Arlie Hochschild about her new book, that looked at her experience of spending 5 years with Tea Party conservatives in Louisiana's Bayou country. And let's go to more calls. Let's go to Jim in Russian River. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Excellent conversation. I had a question for your guest that kind of ties in with waiting in line. As a liberal, I feel like I'm waiting in line for the right to get real about global warming and all the things that I hold dear. I'm wondering, in your conversations with these folks, if you felt any sentiment to breaking up the United States in a Brexit manner, like United Countries of America. I'll take my answer off the
thanks,
line.
Thanks, Jim.
Yeah. So, you know, it's I didn't get much Brexit sentiment, but there was a feeling that the country is divided. And of course, in the South, there is a whole tradition of secession, and the federal government seems like the North to them. So the preconditions for Brexit exit are there, but I didn't hear them talk a lot about it.
In this narrative, was there anything that you found that broke through that narrative that you know, seemed to resonate? Or were you left there to try that out and understand?
That would be great. I can't say I did that, but I guess I feel like we, or liberal progressives, have another narrative, too. We have our deep story. And I think in that, we're all ranged around a public square. And we're not holding hands because we're ready to incorporate someone else who is ranged around this public square. So the circle around the square can get larger. And then in the middle of the square is a fantastic children's museum that has all kinds of new bells and whistles. And there's a Save the Whales kind of campaign. And there are state-of-the-art public schools and theaters. And we are the builders of this public square. We're fiercely proud of that public square. And then we see someone bursting in to the circle and taking out chunks of concrete from that public school and other chunks of concrete from that public theater and disrupting it and, insult to injury, building a McMansion behind our back with that private money and dismantling this thing we feel is so precious and incorporative. And we turn not so much to the Constitution. We do the Constitution, but also to the Statue of Liberty, who says, you know, take in your huddled and your poor.
Well, I think we have time for one last call. Anne in San Jose. Hi, Anne.
Hi. I just wanted thank you so much for having this guest speaker. I am a nurse in San Jose, where I heard an immigrants' rights person say that 80% of the people in this valley are from other countries. And coming in as a European white American and working in the medical field, I feel such cultural dissonance. Even though I love the diversity and I love working with so many people from other countries, it feels like I have no home here. It doesn't feel like the America I knew. And sometimes some of the things Donald Trump, I kind of feel empathetic with him. And I'm afraid to say that I would never vote for him. But I feel like even now there's some issues going on with me going into the workplace. Mm-hmm.
Well, Anne, thank you. You know, we're running out of time, but I think you underscore the point that Trump is an emotions candidate, which
yes.
is what you've described,
yes.
Arlie Hochschild.
And thank you for that.
Yeah. Well, you know, one last thought to end on. Maggie writes, I have to wonder about the reverse situation. What if a white Southern academic came to the Bay Area with a similar quest to understand the views in this enclave?
Mm-hmm.
How would we be as welcoming as the Louisiana citizens were? Well, Arlie Hochschild, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
This has been great. Thank you so much.
Arlie Hochschild's new book is Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right. You can catch her at Books, Inc. in Berkeley on September 6th at the Niebuhr Proctor Library in Oakland at 6:30 on September 10th, and on September 14th at the Commonwealth Club of California's Outdoor Art Club in Mill Valley. This is Forum. Thanks for listening. I'm Mina Kim.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and the Bernard Osher Foundation, supporting higher education and the arts.